for joining us. I am Matt Pizzolo. I am the sort of quasi-moderator. I think it'll mostly be a discussion about science elements in comics. Probably the easiest way to start is if everyone just introduces themselves, and maybe we'll start the other side with Charles.
Sure. My name is Charles Soule. I write a bunch of stuff, but the stuff that's relevant to this panel are two series, or two projects. One's called Strange Attractors, which is about sort of mathematics and complexity theory as applied to New York City. And the other is called Letter 44, which is about a manned mission to the asteroid belt that occurs after we find our evidence of aliens kind of hanging out up there doing something suspicious and secret. So,
cool. I'm Patrick Meany. I wrote a series called Last Born for Black Mask, which is kind of lost with a whole bunch of concepts from Cosmos thrown in. So a lot of Big Bang and post-apocalyptic global warming, destroy the Earth type stuff.
So. Cheerful. I wallow in that too. Hi, my name is Derek Robertson. I'm a co-creator of a book called Ballistic that I did for Black Mask with Adam Egan Mortimer, who really should be sitting here talking about science instead of me, but I'll do my best to fill in his absence. I also co-created a book called Transmetropolitan, which is all about the future and how crazy technology kind of overwhelms and takes over everything subtly the way it's doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I'm very hot. I'm Matt Pizzolo. I run a company called Black Mask Studios. So we put out Ballistic and also Last Word. And I wish that we had put out some of the other cool products that have been pointed out so far. I have a book that is based on an animated show that I did prior to being part of Black Mask called God Killer, and a follow-up that's coming up in May called Young Terrorists, and both of them tap into kind of speculative science and the ideas of what we'll be able to do when we are melding sort of new forms of bioengineering and DNA engineering with more metaphysical aspects. And I'm also receiving texts from a couple of our fellow panelists who are waking up in pools of their own vomit right now. Wishing they could be joining us. And I guess, you know, I think it's going to be more of a general discussion, so everybody can just jump in and be aggressive. But I think the easiest way to get things started is if anyone wants to tackle, you know, the current trend in science fiction and how it's a little bit different, because it does seem like there is more of a basis in fact right now.
I'd agree with that. I saw Interstellar, and I was impressed with the fact that the setup for the movie was a good example of how science fiction is starting to look through a more realistic lens, and something we had already been doing. We addressed climate change and socioeconomic politics and overpopulation in Ballistic. These things can be, as dreary as they sound, also be inspirational, because when you can think your way out of a problem, even if you're dreaming or imagining, that still is a root. Sometimes those things that were fantastic just 20 years ago, we walk around with now. If anybody doesn't ever stop and go, holy crap, I have Star Trek in my hand now, and you're from my generation, then you're kind of missing out on life. Or like Louis C.K. says, you're complaining about not getting peanuts or your drink quick enough in your plane. You're not realizing you're sitting in a chair hurtling through the air at 700 miles an hour, and you should just be going, oh my God, oh my God! Because it's amazing what we take for granted now, and that's because technology and science creeps into our lives in a subtle way.
Well, yeah, I think I directed a documentary about Warren Ellis, so I talked with Warren a lot, and he was always kind of saying, like, people are mad you don't have a flying car, but, you know, they never imagined something like an iPhone or the internet or a computer.
Yeah, there's your flying car right there.
I think to just to continue speaking to the point, I think that readers and viewers and audiences in general are becoming sharper. You know, I think as we all kind of, you know, learn more about the world and how technology affects us, like, I think there's a certain, you know, an accuracy meter, an accuracy radar that people have. And you can kind of tell when somebody's faking it or doing, like, sketchy science or things like that. And the opposite is also true. I think there's something that comes through when you've done your homework and your book, you know, feels legit because it is as legit as you can. I mean, you always have to bend stuff. You can't make it perfect. You can try. But I love trying to get the details right. you know, Letter 44 is a book about space travel, and I was contacted by, like, NASA got in touch early on, and I've been to Kennedy twice now. I've seen a launch, like, I've, you know, they, and that's, that would be awesome under any circumstances, obviously, but it it allows me to get some of these details in that are, it's like the bread and butter for me.
So that's really interesting to me. So based on the book, NASA got in touch with you and invited you out to, like, help them fix the space program?
Yes. Well, the inspiration for Letter 44, actually, was that it was right around the time of the last shuttle launch, which was, you know, a few years ago at this point. And I was extremely frustrated that we were, you know, curtailing our space exploration program, which wasn't even really much of one at that time. I mean, the space shuttle was basically just a cargo truck going back and forth to low Earth orbit. But still, it was something, and it was American, and it was important to me. It had been part of my life since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And so the idea that it was ending was frustrating, and the idea that, you know, we'd shut down Mars and, like, all the other things that we had planned to do, we weren't going to do anymore. I was like, well, what would actually get us to light it up again? And I was like, well, if we knew that there was something extraterrestrial in the asteroid belt, we would go there. We would find a way to, we would do whatever it took to make it happen. Just like in the 60s, we did whatever it took to get up to the moon. So that was the genesis of it. Since then, obviously, we've kind of relit manned space exploration a little bit with the Orion and stuff, which is great. But the way that I got to go to NASA, to actually answer your question, was I was doing a signing in Orlando, which is, you know, the city in Florida right by Kennedy, and a dude was in the line, and he comes up, and he had me sign some Red Lanterns and Swamp Thing. But then he's like, I really like... You know, Letter 44 is great. That's the reason I wanted to come out. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, I work in that field. I'm like, what do you mean you work in that field? He's like, well, I'm a NASA engineer. I'm one of the guys who's building the Orion. And I was just, you know, the line stopped dead. You know? I talked to him for maybe 15 minutes. And then he's like, you know, we really appreciate, or what they're sort of an outreach program, kind of like an unofficial outreach thing where they want people who are writing realistically about science fiction. About science fact in science fiction, who are portraying these things in a way that celebrates the work that they do, you know, to come check it out and sort of be evangelists almost for science, which I was all about. And so he's like, you know, if it ever works in your schedule, you can come to Kennedy. I'm like, I would be there tomorrow. I would be there right now. Let's go. So I went down a few months later, and then he's like, you should really come down for lunch sometime. And so I said again, you know, next time there's a launch, and the next... big launch was the Orion capsule, which was in December, I think. So I was down there for that, which was super cool. You get up at 5 in the morning. They open. I got up at 3 because there's a line. But you get up and they... I'm talking a lot. I'm sorry. But they open Kennedy, like the visitor center, early. And it's pitch black. You know, it's the middle of the night. It's 3:30. And they have like kind of like ambient techno going. And there's this thing called the Rocket Garden, which has, you know, the... all the rockets that have gone up, the Mercury, the Gemini, all the different launch vehicles are there. And they have like lighting around them. It looks like a rave. So you're just sort of like walking among the rockets with this pulsing, throbbing music at 3:30 in the morning. And then you go see a rocket take off as the sun rises. It was one of the coolest things I have ever or will ever do.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, somebody else.
Well, it's interesting to me in that I find if you would like, I love Mystery Science Theater, and so you get to see old sci-fi movies that you would never watch otherwise. And when you see, you know, the pilot driving, you know, flying through space and he's smoking a cigarette, you know, that's where you see science fiction. And you realize, like, you know, they couldn't have that because there's compressed air and they're just kind of comfortably way heavy in their seats when they would probably be floating around. And, you know, and that's a good example of where we now have, you know, we laugh at that now because then they had never been into space. So they really didn't know what to expect or how that would feel or how these guys would act. You watch old Twilight Zones and it's the same kind of thing. Like, we're on an alien planet and the first thing they do, they whip off their helmets. You know? Ah, smell that H2O. And, But as we've matured and we, you know, we're walking around with encyclopedias in our hands, what used to take up a whole bookshelf or a day trip to the library can be answered in a couple of seconds with typing on your phone. And therefore, you know, are the BS detector is, you know, heightened as a result because you could fact check everything in a moment.
I think it's interesting, you know, for us as writers, creators, and artists who are creating a new science world, we're operating in a time... I have a 5-year-old son who, when he was 3, decided he was obsessed with the periodic table on YouTube. And like, while his friends are learning all the names of the Transformers, he's learning all the elements. And it's, I didn't have that opportunity when I was a kid because I didn't have YouTube where it was whatever I was interested in, I could go down that rabbit hole. But I feel like now we have so much access to so much advanced science at our fingertips that you can learn anything you want. And it certainly probably raises the pressure on writers and artists. I mean, how long you and Adam were working for 5 years on Ballistic?
I mean, Adam's real fetish. If you've not read Ballistic or if you don't know what that is, let me tell you really quickly. It's set in a future world where basically Western society has collapsed. And based on science reality, I had an idea that this place where our main character, Butch, who's an air conditioning repairman, wannabe hitman for the mob, is living. It's called Repo City State. But there's actually right now a giant trash island, like two times the size of Texas, floating around in the Pacific. And it's accumulating. And I thought, well, what if there was a way to actually get and harness that thing and turn it into livable space? My friend Joe Harris happened to be postulizing the same thing and did a great book called Great Pacific, if you get a chance. So we were laughing because both our books were about to come out, and we went, oh, wait, we got the same. But it's like his happens 200 years before ours would. But it's a really good, but in Ballistic, the science of DNA becomes manipulatable. So everything is terraformed into a living city. You can they grow buildings and they grow technology as opposed to build them. So raw material is just transformed from what exists. And it becomes this kind of perfect green eco-living place where everything else on the planet has since basically gone to rot. And it's an interesting... And all the technology within the story is... real on some level, because Adam Mortimer meticulously scoured and included his ideas, and in the back of every issue there's like a glossary and links and directions to the actual science. He he did his thinking on. He used his thinking machine and created the story that it does draw back to real science. So when you read the book, there's crazy ideas, and then you realize, oh, it's only crazy because we could actually do this on some level right now, such as there are three... And when I did Transmetropolitan, I thought I was really thinking outside the box. A lot of the gadgets and stuff people had in the street was just me having fun. Warren and I collaborated, and we'd throw that idea ball back and forth, but a lot of times I'd just be running with it. But Warren had this great idea for the Maker, which is one of the first things we meet in Transmetropolitan. And I thought that would be the coolest thing. You put a brick inside, and then you ask for what you want, and boom, out it comes.
Now what that sounds like.
That'll never happen. A 3D printer. Well, it doesn't happen right now. And that what's so crazy is I just found out that within probably our lifetimes, 30 years or so, of the people sitting in this room, they'll be able to print out a human heart that they can put inside you from your DNA. Making organ transplants a thing of the past. That's happening right now. And that just makes my head go...
I actually read a story, and I hope I'm not getting the details wrong, but I feel like they 3D printed an artificial penis. That is apparently going to be effective.
There's actually just a shop about two blocks from
here. I know.
You don't have to go through all that trouble.
One that was supposed to, like, a functional, the whole bit, you know? And I think it was for mice. Like, they made it work for mice. So there's a little work to go.
Because we don't have enough of them. No, it is.
Oh. One thing that I think is interesting now, and it's both interesting as like a person who's interested in science and troubling as a writer, is the kind of like takedowns of movies like Gravity or Interstellar, where like Neil deGrasse Tyson will be like, well, Gravity was, you couldn't do this. Like, what do you think about that as some people who are sort of like on both sides of the divide?
I feel like it's interesting that... Well, do you have a comment on that, Charles? Because I have something near it.
I think you drama, you know, our job is not to write a science textbook. Our job is to write a compelling story that will get people interested in the issues that they can then research further and look into if they need to. It's not always easy. You know, there's always a balance. And some books go very far towards the fantasy, and that's where you get Game of Thrones and stuff. And then there's the ones that go very, very far in the other direction. And then, you know, you're basically just attending a class or something. It's not a dramatic story necessarily. So an ideal situation is sort of, for me, would probably be hitting right around like here. So it's as accurate as I can do, acknowledging some of the things that I've got to fudge, stuff we haven't invented yet, things that are in development but aren't quite there. Because ultimately, if it's boring, then all the work you do to get the science right is lost because nobody's going to keep reading it. But if it's interesting and compelling and a fun story, then you can sneak the concepts in as you go.
Cool. And I think the other side of, there's certainly the takedown culture, but I think there's also, you know, Gravity, Interstellar, those are standalone pieces, but mm-hmm. what we all work in is serialized. And I've certainly found, when my series Godkiller was on Netflix and Hulu, there was probably about 1 million people watching it, and the comments were so robust that people were coming back with more information than I was able to research on my own, because it's just such a larger pool. And because I was still working on it, the comments that I was getting, even just, you know, when it went on YouTube, there's just like everyone talking, and it becomes this social network around the ideas of the story. Mm-hmm. And I found that that personally really instructed. It didn't change the plot, but it might have changed some of the mechanics of the science moving forward, because I was actually learning from the audience. Has anyone else experienced that?
Yeah. I mean, I was most impressed with Interstellar in the regard that where it wanted to bring a lot of science fact into it. It was, Chris Nolan seemed to be striving to tell a very human story within that. It was more about, like the, even where if you feel, some people that I've talked to about the movie, it feels that it goes too far at one point, that it gets almost intangible, like almost like the end of 2001, where you're not really sure what's going on and what Kubrick was trying to say. But at the same time, I was most impressed with how it built up to why he went into space, because mm-hmm. it showed the effects of where, hey, corn's dying now, and everybody's a farmer, and there's no armies left. Like, that almost sounds idyllic on some level, and then you go, oh, but that's also kind of horrifying. And that was a great place to start, because that's science fact. That can't happen on our planet, you know?
I think that's interesting, because most kind of, like, dystopian things, I think, have an element. Like, even Transmet, it's like, this is a cool world I want to live in, even though it's like, it's a terrible world.
I wouldn't live in that world for a hot second.
I think you'd live there too long, so yeah. You're sick of it.
Other side of the world that anyone would live in?
Well, I mean, I think even like The Walking Dead, I think people, you watch that show and you're like, it would be bad to have zombies, but it would be kind of cool to like not have a job and like just kind of wander around.
Every supermarket is free food if you go with a machete.
I mean, the Last Man on Earth show is basically like the fun version of The Walking Dead without zombies, where it's just like, oh, I'll buy this, I'll drink this wine, I'll steal this painting and stuff.
And
like,
so lonely, so
So going to NASA, did that impact the story?
Well, at the time that happened, I had written maybe the first, you know, six issues or so, and I had done a lot of homework on, it's manned space travel. We all probably have our, like, science fetishes. That's why we write the books we write, yeah, and manned space travel has always been one of mine. So I'd read a lot of, you know, I knew the Apollo program pretty well, and to the extent that you can. Do any of us have, like, serious science backgrounds? I mean, I do not.
No.
So there's always that.
I watch Cosmos.
So there's always kind of, like, you know, imposter syndrome a little bit when you're writing these things. You want to make sure that you're, you know, I would say I try to double, triple check stuff, and I'm sure I still get stuff wrong. But I read a lot. There's been a lot of, you know, astronaut culture has become kind of a thing with the space station being up there. And, you know, you get YouTube videos by Chris Hadfield and guys like that who are, you know, singing David Bowie songs. It's so, like, we as you know, consumers of endless media know more about what it's like to be in space than we did even 10 or 15 years ago. So I knew a lot of stuff when I wrote the first six issues, but then when I went to NASA and got to see some of the facilities, like, I went to Mission Control, I got to see, like, there's this great, I mean, this is a sad story, actually. It was very cool to see it, but there's this wall of shuttle missions, okay, and basically they have the date that it went up and the date that it came back down. And it's a wall, it's not a publicly accessible place, it's just, you know, the building that Mission Control is in. And so you walk along that wall, and then there's the Challenger mission and the Columbia mission, and they are, you know, they don't have a return date because they didn't return. And where the date would be, the wall is, like, worn away because so many people have touched it. And so, like, it's little details like that that are just,
beautiful.
It gives you goosebumps.
That's fantastic.
So things like, I didn't put that in the book because I'm not going to put that in the book. I guess I just told a room full of strangers. but, you know, there are a lot of other things. Like the way we went, the upcoming arc of the book, the third arc, is very much about kind of how the spaceship was built that goes to the asteroid belt, which is a gigantic engineering challenge, like on the level of, you know, Apollo or whatever. And so I talked my engineering friend through what I was thinking about doing and like how project management works and how you get divided up and how people regard the you know, the boss, right? Like the head, you know, the NASA director who's actually running the project. And a lot of that really was extremely informative because he told me how they break out into units, and it's just different groups are assigned different tasks, and then they come back together, and sometimes they're, you know, fractious, and sometimes they're all like, you know, lovey-dovey, just like any big project. He showed me this is just turning into NASA stories, but that's right. He showed me this great.
We're talking about NASA, the science fact now.
Yes. There's this great. So in Mission Control, there are these binders, right? And the binders are thick, and there are, you know, 200 of them, and they're kind of on the shelves under those. You know, you can imagine those terminals where everybody sits. They're sitting in front of a terminal, right? So there are these shelves either behind them or underneath them. And they are contingency plans for everything. So if something goes wrong, it's like, okay, turn to page 214, and that's how we solve this little switch not working on the space shuttle. I don't know. It was just the coolest thing.
Yeah, I like that movie Apollo 13 because they humanized, again, that story of those guys being in such an impossible situation.
Yep. Yep.
And so dire, and the science getting them through and back to Earth when it shouldn't have happened.
Well, they're geniuses. I mean, astronauts.
And the calm and presence of mind, because the panic that would hit me, I don't think that I could concentrate on how this part goes together and how I can doohickey that part together to get the lights to come back on in my freezing capsule. That's fascinating to me.
Absolutely.
I felt like I stepped on your... pressure point when we're talking about organ printing with a dumb joke, but what's really fascinating about what you did bring up about the mice, though, is that if that works, that means that it's a way of keeping a species alive.
Oh yeah,
you know, and that, you know, as we face extinction of animals and we're looking at that a lot, that if there's ways to make more animals happen without it being the natural process, how does that unlock the future?
Sure. Do you guys do a lot of sort of cutting edge readings? You know, like, Wired magazine comes to mind, but that's where you could start, and then you could really dig in deep to, you know, I know Warren Ellis seems like he's always living in this strange demimonde of bizarre sci-fi ideas.
Yep.
How do you guys approach that?
I think for me, I'll usually not so much like read a whole wide swath of stuff, but kind of read about stuff that I'm interested in. Like, I read a lot of nonfiction stuff. Both, you know, I'm really into like trippy, sort of like weird CIA experiments and drug experiments and stuff like that. So I read all these books about that, and it kind of sparks ideas from there.
MK Ultra, that was the
MK Ultra, all those like 50s things is just like that's, and like quantum, you know, time, weird time stuff and stuff. So it's like I'll read those books and not necessarily want to replicate it exactly, but it just sparks ideas that are based on what science is doing. But then you kind of like wander off to like, oh, that's a cool concept. Like in Interstellar, I think they just used the concept of the black hole and welded it to this like emotional arc, and it worked really well.
Yeah, I think so too. I think my approach to it, because with Transmetropolitan, some of that stuff was just me having fun visually and think, but I was always thinking about what people need, and I would base it on what I needed at the time, because I managed to live in three different cities while creating that book. And one of them was in Europe. I was living in Florence, and it's just seeing how as people change, people don't change. And what's interesting about seeing all these different cities is that a city is a city is a city. It doesn't matter really, like the culture impacts it, but it's still humans trying to get what they need. And so I would think about what do humans need on a daily basis, and those things would kind of curve the science around it. I want to get somewhere really fast. I need to get some food right away. I need to be comfortable and safe and feel, you know, while I'm outside, so I don't just sit in my apartment screaming all the time, you know. So how do I, what do they need to feel safe in this world? These things would kind of direct me to even, and also with ballistic, it's like where, if they're living in this world, what would they need? And what kind of things would they use? And that's when you start cracking open those questions with science fact and take the limits off of what it can do, you start getting interesting science fiction.
Yeah, I think it's really, it's, you know, so as science fiction writers, we're sort of all futurists in a way. And you know, we're trying to see where technology and culture might go. But I find it like, so we've been talking about 3D printers, we've been talking about smartphones, and the other one that I would kind of add to that list of significant kind of ground level changes to technological society would be drones, you know, like in a lot of different ways. But I, if you would ask me, like I could not have predicted any one of those things being, I mean, so it's amazing that, that you guys put the maker in Transmit.
Yeah, Google Glass happened, and that was my, I came up with the glasses because
You did? You invented Google Glass?
Well, on Transmetropolitan, I did. Uh-huh.
But, you know what we need is we need sci-fi writers to also have, like, every publisher has to have a patent attorney.
Right. I like that idea. No, within co-created Transmetropolitan, I had another character I created that had a big red eye on his costume, a guy named Nightman, and was supposed to be able to take photographs. And I didn't get to explore that concept the way I thought I would. So when I got a chance to co-create again, when I was creating Spider Jerusalem, I made those glasses up for him, and that's what they were supposed to do. This left lens, it's the rectangle, is actually like a computer that he can do with his eye, and this one was for like taking photographs and running MP3s or whatever it is he wants it to do. And so, and Warren at first was like, "Why?" It wasn't part of his original idea for Spider. And so even if you read issue one, when the maker spits those out, Spider's reaction to him was like, "What are these? What, are you on drugs again?" Because that was his little slam at me. But I thought that was, but it ended up being very helpful for the character. But I actually figured he would need these because I didn't see this coming, but I did sort of imagine that being necessary because you usually have your hands full when you're out and about doing your thing, got a coffee or whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. You look at guys like Elon Musk or the Segway guy, spacing.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, well, these guys were really good at making up the next thing, and it doesn't always take. Like Segway, that was supposed to revolutionize transport. Like every city was supposed to be redesigned around Segways, and as we have seen, cities have not been redesigned around Segways.
Like warehouses.
Yeah, so. Yeah. That's true. I mean, it's a useful gadget. That's been integrated into society in a real way, but it's just not, you know, I've never ridden one. I don't know if any of us have ever ridden one. But
I've ridden one. They're actually incredibly difficult.
And oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I almost killed myself on it.
That's probably why they haven't caught on, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever had the experience where something that you design in the period of time that it takes, because it can take a long, you might have, like, a bunch of ideas, and in the time that it takes to bring it to fruition or to market, it's actually... It was speculative at the time, and it's no longer. Like, I had something where, years ago, I had a science fiction story where the idea was every character has a government issue. I wasn't calling it a drone at the time, but a camera that follows them everywhere they go, and that was sort of the point of view of it. And then by the time we got through it, it's no longer science fiction anymore. That would just be contemporary. Like, have you had that experience where something that was speculative became not speculative?
Just with Transmit, I'm seeing it come true, which is weird, but... Yeah.
In Letter 44, the ship, I designed the ship and its propulsion system, everything like that, back in, I guess this probably would have been 2012, 2011. And just since then, with Orion and, like, all the other things that we're doing, like, what I would assume would be the only way that it would get up there has now been completely outpaced, and they're going to do something else. It's just, you know, technology moves really fast, and getting comics out is slow. Mm-hmm. So it's inevitable.
Yeah. It was interesting when we were doing the Ellis project, we went to this company called Berg, who are in England, and basically Ellis himself is a consultant, and they kind of, like, looked at his comics and were like, this is a cool concept, we want to do this. So it was basically sort of the reverse of that, where it's like they're just picking stuff out of comics and out of, you know, sci-fi and being like, how can we make this real?
Right. Also, if anyone has questions, maybe you could line up at the mic, and then we will regularly just stop talking. So, here we go. Set it off.
I was just curious, early on in the talk, you were talking about how audiences are becoming more discerning in terms of making sure that their science fiction aligns with science fact. And I was wondering if you thought that applied both to harder types of sci-fi, as well as, you know, the classic sort of soft science fiction like Star Trek and things like that. If everything is shifting more towards harder science fiction,
it seems to me that when you watch, when you watch old Star Trek, there's things that are laughable about it now, And at the time, it was considered so cutting edge, and it's been endearing and enduring, and it keeps getting rebooted. So it that kind of shows, as an example, like there's an appetite for the softer stuff. And, you know, like with Star Wars, I don't think people really worry too much about the science. Like there's a part of it where it looks like it works, and therefore you accept that it does. But with Star Trek, you're a little more picky because they look like they're doing, like it's almost like a corporation in space. Everybody's got their job, and they're running it like it's kind of like a friendly military. And so people are taking, there's a order to things, and
Well, Star Wars is more fantasy, really.
Right.
Star
Trek, like I said, it's more like a... Right, so you accept one more than the other like, hey, the Millennium Falcon just flies, because they say it does. And I'm going to go through hyperspace and not manage not to like run into 18 moons on the way, because we say we can. And you just go, great, and it goes, and you're on for the ride, and...
I mean, I always think about in the movie Thank You for Smoking.
Yeah.
They're talking about, like, how are we going to put a cigarette product placement in space? And they're like, but you can't smoke in space. And they're like, we'll throw in a line. Like, it's so great we can smoke in space now. Like, you can always kind of, you know,
we're back to
come
studies.
Up with
stuff.
Yeah.
And come full circle.
I have a two-part question. One, when do you do the bulk of your research? After you've already been world building, or kind of beforehand, and that's what you build the world around? Also, how helpful has things like Reddit been when you have questions, you can ask professionals on it? Do you guys use that a lot?
I don't think the research ever stops. I don't know if you guys feel the same way. Like, I do my research before, I do it during. I like reading the stuff. It's not really work in the same way that some other things would be. So I'm always reading new things. And as far as Reddit, I don't know. I don't use that. I mean, I feel like the problem with that is it can be difficult to filter out an authoritative voice from just some random dude on the internet. And I know that those people are available on Reddit, but I don't know.
It's hard to consider the source. You know?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. I think for me, it's like I'll usually kind of have a rough idea, and then I'll try to read stuff that's related to it, and then kind of build it out of that and just keep reading more stuff about the world to kind of get new ideas and just kind of like add some color to it.
Yeah, I think I found that places like Reddit and I think Quora would be another one where you might put out a question.
Yahoo Answers, right?
Yahoo Answers is where that's my spot. But I think that, you know, what becomes important for us is when there are people who become passionate about the stuff that we're tapping into, and then reach out to us, and then we realize that they have a knowledge in the area, then that becomes more collaborative, I think.
Yeah, I've on different projects, like I'm finding it, like one thing that's been really, really great about, you know, my profile has been getting higher in the business, and so I can now kind of send an email to someone, and I don't always get an answer back, but there's, you know, it's a 50-50 shot, and so I'll usually give it a shot, and you know, like it's...
Elon, what do you think of this?
Yeah, that's less than 50-50. But like there are people like, you know, the NASA guys, the astronomers I've been talking, you know, whatever, you can find them. It's cool.
Fascinating.
Looking at the recent failure of Mars One, companies like SpaceX, which use crowdfunding for scientific development, things like that, where do you guys see that going, and does that affect the way you write crowdfunding as a way to develop and also in science fiction?
I think Mars One was... I don't think that they... I don't know. Mars One, they didn't ask for $6 billion, right? They benchmarked it, you know? And it got people talking about and thinking about a Mars mission. The more that becomes an established goal for humanity, the better. And so I don't really care who's trying to do it as long as lots of people are doing it. And Buzz Aldrin and notable space figures are talking about going to Mars. I mean, one of my, you know, we all have a lot of dreams. One of mine is to see us on Mars before I die. And I don't know if that will happen or won't happen, because I get hit by a car today. But the more we think of that as an achievable goal as a species, the more likely it is to happen, and the more likely people are to put resources into it. So the fact that I even made $300,000 on going to Mars is pretty wild.
I think it's amazing, like when, you know, I watched a whole documentary on how what it actually would do to a person to get us to Mars, and the interesting challenges of what outer space does to the human body, and how we lose bone density if we're out in space too long, and our muscles atrophy. things like that that you really wouldn't consider. And then the idea of, well, do we really need to be there as human beings? Can we have a whole civilization on Mars that we're just kind of like droning? Like we're all home in our little pods and with things up our nose and esophagus tubes, but we're actually living mentally through these little robots or drones that are on Mars at this point. So we aren't using up as much resources, but we're having our social life on another planet.
A matrix-like existence?
Kind of a matrix-like existence, yeah. But except it's all on another planet, you know. Like,
boom,
but
like, print that one.
The way we got the rovers going there now. So, but or the idea that maybe they were kind of running up, exploring an interstellar where we just send human seeds there and then we actually build human beings on that planet so they don't have to make that leap, you know. It's really fascinating when you start to eliminate some basic ideas based in science fact. If you start to eliminate things like, okay, well, we have to have X, Y, and Z, and you start to take apart that picture of, like I said, the space captain with the cigarette or, you know... That's the basic model, and sometimes we, as science fiction people imagining things, we make the mistake of relying too heavily on the established cliches, the things that are just a given, because those things that are a given, I'm experiencing this firsthand, like 20 years ago, are no longer a given, and I'm fascinated by how quickly that changed. My father was an airline mechanic for most of his life, and was a lieutenant during World War II in the Air Force. And his life was so interesting to me because he said to me, as he had me late in life, so when he was getting ready to get in his older years, he said, in the time I've been alive, he was born in 1916, but he said, in the time that I was alive, I watched everybody go from horse and cart to go down to the market to the moon and then to home computers. He goes, what happened in this 100 years that made us just go shh? And because up until then, 1816 to 1916, not a lot of change in the way technology happened. But from 1916 to the present day, pretty quick curve.
How about like 0 AD to, you know, 1780? You know, like,
yeah, exactly.
Like things, yeah, it's amazing. When it's I'm just exponential
talking about, curve. That's my dad. I think in just two lifetimes, I'm sitting here talking to you guys, and that was my father. So it's like, if it's happening that quickly, where, you know, what's going to happen by the time
we talk about a post-scarcity society, right, which is when resources are no longer an issue. It's just we don't have to think about where power is going to come from or anything like that anymore. And I read a great book about basically mining the asteroid belt, and there's science has its evangelists just like anything else, and this guy is almost like an old-timey preacher about how we could solve all our problems if we could just mine the asteroid belt. And it's very compelling. I mean, you look at, you know, a 3D printer, right? And all that really needs is a basic set of elements. You can make anything. And all that stuff is out. You know, there are asteroids just full of it. So we could just go there and focus our energies on doing that, which is not easy to do, I realize. But then, like, all of humanity, everything we think of as an issue right now, like food and resources and water and everything, we just don't have to think about anymore. And then what could we do if we could solve those problems?
Brings me back right to remembering, have you ever seen Red Dwarf? And there's like the human side of that exact project, because they're basically space miners.
Yeah. So
I think to the point about crowdsourcing, it's interesting that we've had so many science fiction stories about privatization of these things, but I don't know that I've come upon predicting crowdfunding or
that's a cool thing.
I would love to see the will of the people actually make stuff like that happen. That would be an amazing change in the way, again, those predispositions of how things happen.
Well, you know, the selfie stick was crowdfunded originally. So that's nice. Changed society dramatically.
Yeah.
Anyway, we should probably... What's your point?
Yeah, Tennyson.
So you mentioned previously it's kind of almost a tradition within the sci-fi community, sci-fi writer community, where they imagine something and then physical researchers or a company goes, oh, hey, let's take that and market it. Is there something that you, or I guess all the panel, has there been something that you've created or you've made into one of your stories that you go, oh, this is really cool, I spent a lot of time researching this, this is something that I would like to see happen, and then after you kind of commit it, you go, oh, no, this would be really terrible. Like, do you have an example?
What do you think? I I don't think anybody really need Butch's gun. If you ever read Ballistic, that gun is insane and does drugs and has a mind of its own. And Butch is almost giving over his. He's got a whole bunch of tattoos on one arm that the gun has, it looks like an alien creature practically. But it's got its own personality, but it has a tail that whips out and wraps around his arm, and there's bioconnectors within that tattoo that allow them to be one person and starts feeding off his adrenaline. So it's like, but the gun has become like almost drug addicted to the adrenaline. So he actually gets Butch into trouble so he can get his fix. So where this guy's trying to, you know, be calculating about what he does, the gun's got a mind of its own. And so he'll be trying to, like, I don't know, break a code on a door to get out, and the gun will be shooting all on its own and screaming and laughing.
That sounds like a great image.
I can imagine that would be almost like a horror show to have invented that and benefiting from it long enough to realize, oh, it's addicted to me.
I just want to know, who are your favorite sci-fi authors?
Neal Stephenson is probably my favorite one. I read a lot of science fiction stuff, but he's above and beyond for me. But there's a lot.
Philip K. Dick, probably.
Yeah, I love Kurt Vonnegut. Cat's Cradle was science fiction.
Yeah, Slaughterhouse Titan. I mean, he wrote a bunch of science fiction stuff.
I love Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, I like, I guess Ellison, but I'm only not saying Stevenson because it's already been said.
He's amazing. He's got a new book coming out, you know, it's about a generation shift, which I think will be crazy.
Yeah, anyway. Player Piano was another Vonnegut book that was a really prescient look at how society was bifurcating into the workers and the haves and the have-nots, and also how computers would become so prevalent in our lives that he postulized that there's these two bars. And one bar, it's, you can go in and put a, it was like all automated. You could go in and you put your card in and you can get a drink and it's measured perfectly and it's the best alcohol and it's clean and it's sterile. Nobody goes there. Everybody goes across the bridge to the crappy dive bar where there's a piano where 15 of the keys don't work but somebody's always trying to play it and the bartender is surly and there's peanut shells on the floor. That place is packed. And I guess even with all these advanced technologies, there's a longing for that human contact, and that doesn't change. So I thought that was really fascinating in the world of sci-fi.
There's another author who's older. His name's Philip Wiley. He wrote Gladiator was one of his books. It was the book that Superman kind of inspired Superman. But he also wrote a lot of really cool. There's one where like all of the whole world gets split into basically two dimensions. One only has men, one only has women. And this was in like 1953 or something. So society was very different. That's a good one. But my favorite one was written in the Cold War, and it's about a massive, devastating nuclear strike. The Soviet Union sticks gigantic hydrogen bombs in all the harbors of the main big cities of America, detonates them all, and everything, like the states are just vaporized. And we do a retaliatory strike, and the Soviet Union is vaporized. And the entire world is gone, right? But, like, seven people live in an underground shelter that some brilliant billionaire put together. And then it's about them kind of surviving for 2 or 3 years, and they come out on the Earth, which is apparently okay now, after this destruction. And then, you know, seven people have survived in the whole world. And the title of the book is Triumph with an exclamation mark. Now, I don't know if I'd call it a triumph, but anyway, so sorry, I digress.
I think just now that I've got a second to think about it, Aldous Huxley is probably my favorite.
Oh, yes, I love Aldous Huxley.
One thing that's amazing about him is Brave New World is my favorite book, but then Brave New World Revisited is like this panel, except with somebody who's like a titan, where he's going back and looking at what actually happened that he had predicted.
We should get to the
Let's do that.
Lightning round.
So I recently took a class on climate change communication. So I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts on how effective the fictional explorations of some of these serious issues that you and other creators are doing have on building public awareness and support for action on these issues. Or are we just kind of preaching to the choir with this audience that's already interested in it?
Yes and yes. But, you know, every conversation that you're informed on makes you a more interesting and more informative person. So even preaching to the choir, sharing ideas, that's a good thing in my opinion. Anything that gets people at least believing and aware that this is actually happening and that it's going to affect everybody in ways we can't even predict, is an important discussion to be having.
Yeah, it was funny because my book has a lot about sort of like the Big Bang and kind of universes creation and stuff. And somebody came up to me, I was like, I like the book, but I don't agree with the message. And I was like, what?
Well, I like eggs. Like, I don't agree eggs come in shells.
Yeah, he was like,
in cartons.
I just, you know, like, you know, God created the earth. And I was like, I mean,
good enough.
All right, whatever.
There's not a scientific discussion at that point.
First, thanks for having such a topic, very unique. Second, you already mentioned many, many scientists would be more than happy to receive emails. You can search internet for papers that are similar to this, and many of them will be more than happy to answer and be involved with your stuff. I speak as a scientist. One of the main complaints that scientists have are not the major topics, but the second and third level. For example, in Star Wars, where you have these huge moons sitting right next to each other, the tidal effects would be
right.
disastrous.
Yeah.
Or having rainbows next to the sun, or having the crescent moon pointing in the opposite direction of the sun. Secondary things like that. How do you deal with, or how do you kind of, do you actually pursue those secondary things that actually annoy the scientists?
As the artist, that becomes very
important. That's very important to me. I actually do very much care about, is the arch, you know, like if there's a crescent moon, is it facing the light, and how light hits things, and, you know, what would gravitational pulls be? And I had a big thing on Wolverine that when I was the artist on Wolverine for a couple of years. I'd grown up on that character, and I loved him so much that I spent just way too much time thinking about how his body would function. And the way I would draw him walking was because I thought, look, if he's got, you know, I've had a cast on my arm when I had an injury, and that weight became something I was ever present aware of because it wasn't part of my body. My body didn't want that there, or didn't know what to do with it, but it needed it. So if he had adamantium-laced bones, that would be an extra weight on him constantly affecting the way he would move. And with the healing factor, see, I think about this stuff way too much, but with the healing factor, I don't know if the way you build muscle if you're working out is you rip your muscles up, you tear them down, and then as they heal, they grow larger. Well, that would be an ever-present process for him. Getting up to get a beer and then go to the bathroom and coming back to the couch, that guy would put on another pound of muscle because he's constantly carrying that weight with him. So that's why he's ripped and doesn't go to the gym. You know, that was my thinking on it. Like, but I love that kind of thinking. So that's my way, at least biologically, the way I approach a science fiction character as an artist.
I did one of the books I wrote recently was Death of Wolverine, right? And
yeah.
One of the big plot points in that book is that he's lost his healing factor. And so I talked to a surgeon friend of mine about how losing his healing factor would affect his body. And one of the best details was that every time he stabs somebody, every time he pops his claws, he basically rips his hands apart. So he can't really do that. But let's say he does, and then he pulls them back into his body, he's sucking all that bacteria and gunk back into himself. So, yeah, it's gross.
Yeah, but infected, anyway. Infected hands, I like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So go ahead, sorry.
Hi. You all talked about the speed of technology change earlier, and one of the interesting things to me is also then the socialization aspects of these technologies, like what does get brought into society, what doesn't get picked up, like sideways, and also we get to see more, it feels like the policy and legal implications of these also moving much more quickly. Are those aspects of the technology that you're coming up with, or the science fiction that you're coming up with, are those also things that you look into or research or look at, like what didn't get picked up by society, or this is a really interesting policy discussion that's going on, what would my technology mean?
Well, it's funny, you look through the history of like the automobile is a good example, like which cars failed on the market is a good example of how technology can be dreamed up in a room to think that this is what the people are going to want, and the people don't want that.
It's the Segway again, you know?
Like, right, yeah. The Segway is a perfect example, but like it's almost the evolution of the car industry leads you on a direct path to why the Segway failed, you know?
Yeah.
The other funny thing, though, is that most technology that is successful was tried and failed 10 years ago. And the infrastructure wasn't in place for it to work.
The iPad.
Automated cars are something that fascinates me because they've done research in the fact that they got cars now that will you can just sit in them and they will drive you to where you need to go and maintain the speed limit and turn your wheels and they'll park for you and get out and walk away from them. These exist. But why, you know, I don't think people are ready to embrace giving up that feeling of freedom that you, when you get behind the wheel of a car, that it goes where you want it to go. Even if you can program it, you need to be holding that wheel and touching that pedal. And but they realized it would cut traffic in half, like almost overnight. The deaths would come down dramatically. There's all these benefits to it. People won't do it. They won't embrace that quickly. I think that's sort of human nature gets in the way of great ideas.
I think we're out of time, so thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much.